The following Dharma talk was given at Boundless Way Temple in Worcester, Massachusetts. The temple is an affiliate of Boundless Way Zen, a multi-lineage school of Zen Buddhism.
So now, as we move into our Teisho and our Dharma dialogue, can people hear me? Is the sound okay?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you. Our custom is to sit in Zazen posture and simply to let the talk flow through you. I'll be giving the first part of the talk. Melissa will be giving the second part of the talk, and then we will have our Dharma dialogue. We would like to use as our text for this session what we've already begun to dip into, which is Lin Ji's nothing to do. Let me read it again. There is no Buddha, no Dharma, no practice, no realization. What is it you seek in others? What is it you lack? It's as though you want to put another head on top of the one you already have. At this very moment, your own wonderful function is no different from the wonderful function of the masters and the Buddhas. It's only because you lack confidence that you seek something outside of you. Make no mistake, there's no Dharma outside you to run after. There's no Dharma within to attain. Rather than seeking, it would be better to hear these words: rest and practice having nothing to do. If something has arisen, don't try to make it continue. If something has not arisen, don't try to make it arise. This action is more valuable than 10 years pilgrimage. There is nothing you need to do. You just need to live as ordinary people. Wear your robe, eat your food. As day follows day, be a person who has nothing to do. And Lin Ji knew what he was talking about. He is our ancestor from the 9th century in China, who at a very young age went to study with multiple masters, many years of pilgrimage, and finally came to rest with one teacher, where he found realization. Lin Ji is the founder of the Lin Ji School of Chan, or as we know it now, the Rinzai School. It's one of the two main schools, as we know, that survives today. And from Rinzai, we have the Koan tradition. Lin Ji was famous for breaking molds. He was known as an iconoclast. Many stories about him talk of his shouting at students, of hitting them as ways to help them wake up, as ways to try to get at what we call thusness, just this, a way to get beyond words and concepts. And this passage, nothing to do, is perfect Lin Ji. It points to two paradoxes of our way. This paradox of seeking when there's nothing to attain, and the injunction to do nothing when this practice is so effortful. He says to us, there's no Buddha, there's no Dharma, there's no practice. And yet, we just vowed to take refuge in Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. And last night, David asked us all, why are you here? What are you seeking? And of course, we are all seekers. But Linji is trying to speak to something that springs eternal in the human heart, which is this wish to find something outside of ourselves to make us whole, to make us what we are not. It's Linji who's famous for saying, if you meet the Buddha on the road, kill him. This endless seeking. As I read this, I remembered how much I loved Superman as a little boy. When I was 6, I got a Superman suit. I got the tights and the t-shirt with the great big S and the mask, and the best thing was the cape. And I would fly around the house and I would jump off furniture because I could fly. I so wanted to put another head on top of my own. And then I would take off my mask and take off my cape, and there I was, small, in this big universe, feeling quite confused. And as I grew up, that hasn't changed a whole lot. How many of us find ourselves yearning for someone else's head to put on top of our own? Some qualities out there that if we could only grab onto, all would be well. We see this in our political life. We see this in our spiritual life. What is it that we get when we go to Doksa? What is it that we get when we seek spiritual guidance from each other? What is it that we offer each other? And of course, Linji is exhorting his young monks and us. See through the stories that we tell each other about what's out there, about who's out there, about who we need to become. And then look deeply at what we can truly give to each other, at what the real refuge is in Buddha and Dharma and in Sangha. And of course, that great big paradox that there is nothing to do. David exhorted us last night to do our best. And Linji himself says the same thing. If you look at the next reading in our sutra book, it's about doing your best. And so what does he mean when he says, be a person with nothing to do? I'm reminded of that iconic story of the young monk who comes to the Zen master and says, Master, if I put in a great effort every single day to attain awakening, how long will it take me? And the master replies, 20 years. And the monk says, no, but if I work really, really hard, how long will it take? And the master says, 40 years. What is this paradox? What is this trap we can fall into of doing. That monk wanting to know how long it's going to take, that monk is me. And I suspect in your heart of hearts, That monk has been you too. What Linji is telling us is not to stop trying, not to stop making effort, and not to be nourished by each other, not just by teachers, but by each of us in this Sangha and each being we encounter. But that Linji tells us it's a bait and switch. What we think we're coming for, when I think I'm coming for my Superman costume, and I'll go home from Sesshin with that wonderful cape, I go home with something different. While we think we're doing one thing here, on the cushion, in our practice, we discover something else entirely. We discover that wonderful function that he talks about, that all of us manifest in each moment. We see the yearnings of the heart. We see the wish to make Herculean effort, all of it as part of our wonderful function. And all of it asking us to just wear our robes, eat our food, be a person, and know intimacy, this life of effortless, wonderful doing. And now Melissa will help us explore this text further.
Continuing to stay seated in your Zazen posture, when the talk is over, we can all bow to each other. Noticing what the effect has been of Bob's words on you. How is it for you? Who did you want to be when you were a small child? Maybe Superman, maybe something else. The very next line after it's as though you want to put another head on top of the one you already have, points directly to what Bob was talking about, beginning to talk about, and what I'd like to explore a little bit more. At this very moment, your own wonderful function is no other than the wonderful function of the masters and the Buddhas. So in some real sense, everything we think about ourselves is a lie because it's too small and constricting. We think that we know who we are. And Dogen, our Soto ancestor from the 13th century, tells us directly to study Buddhism is to study the self. But then he goes right on to say to study the self is to forget the self. So we are full of many, many, many selves. Why not take the opportunity to be the Buddhas and ancestors? Why not take the opportunity to be Superman? We don't even need a cape for it. I bet when you heard Bob talking about his little six-year-old self with the cape running around, you could see it right now. Maybe we'd just have to take the beard off and color his hair a little darker. But there he is, the little boy being Superman. It made me remember that when I was about that age, I wanted to be Annie Oakley, who was a gunfighter in the Old West, but a woman gunfighter. And so I had a cowgirl hat and cowgirl boots and a cowgirl vest, and I had a little plastic horse that rocked back and forth, and little pistols that were just made out of some kind of metal, but they were the shape of a pistol. In that moment that I was running around being Annie Oakley or rocking on the chair, who's to say that I wasn't? When Bob was running around being Superman with his cape, who's to say he wasn't? Luckily, he didn't take it so far that he tried to leap off a building. But the heart-mind has an infinite capacity to be everyone. And this is part of where our compassion comes from. We begin to see, as we sit for long periods of time, especially and during a sesshin, that the person we think we are is bigger, vaster than the little self that narrates our endless follies and mistakes, our successes and our difficulties. What if you were the Buddhas and ancestors, Superman and Annie Oakley? What if instead of putting a head on top of your head, you realized that this body here is the body of a Buddha, the body of the very thing that you have been seeking all of your life, whatever form it takes, Buddha, Annie Oakley, Superman. I'm sure that there are 37 or 38 versions of this on the Zoom screen right now. And this is the promise of this teaching. We were talking earlier about the ocean and floating around on the stormy sea and taking the waves. And this is also true about the self, that we can see the self arising first as calm and peaceful, then as angry. In just a second, it changes. We put on our Superman cape and then we have to take it off when we found that we're not who we thought we were. We wake up in the morning happy and stretching and the sunlight is coming in, and then something happens and knocks us right off. And as we said earlier to one of you who was talking about rushing around, that everything that we encounter is the Buddha Dharma, that everything we are is the Buddha, the awakened one, and that it doesn't look different than this. If we look around at all the Zoom screens right now, we see 38 Buddhas. We see the vastness of the possibility of what it means to be a human being. It's hard to understand, and Bob pointed to the innate paradoxes. This particular reading is so full of paradoxes that it's hard to even imagine how we could ever get through them. And the fact is, we can't get through them by any activity of the intellect. But little by little, something dawns on us, and we begin to realize that we can hold more than one reality at a time. We can hold more than one idea. We can hold more than one self. Many teachings in Zen point to this very thing. We are everything. And if we don't recognize that, then the heart gets very small and tight, and we're incapable of feeling compassion. It's very difficult to open ourselves to the suffering in the world. But for those of us on this path, it's something that we have to do. And we don't do it by thinking, I'm going to open my heart to everyone. Just through the activity that is no activity of sitting upright and still, of giving ourselves completely to that, things begin to clarify. Paradoxes dissolve into wholeness. This is how it is. You don't have to believe what Bob and I are saying, but we do want you to see this for yourself, if you're willing and if you can bear it. The great way, as the third ancestor Seng Tsan says, is not difficult. And Lin Ji says here, there's nothing you need to do. You just need to live as ordinary people. All of this is a pointer to really being fully present in this life.
Thank you.
And now, please relax your posture, and we will have our Dharma dialogue, which we'll do just like we've been doing the other discussions. So, and I encourage you to find a way into what Bob and I were saying that is authentic for you, that is not some idea you have about practice, but something that's really been happening for you, some real experience. We just started the Sesshin last night. It feels like we've been sitting together for quite a long time. So we'll enjoy each other. And also be brave and bold, as another one of our liturgy texts says. Move into the discussion as much as you can. And if you haven't yet raised your hand, this would be a good opportunity to do so. So it's a question or an observation. And David is pointing, and I don't know what he's doing.
Oh, I'm raising my hand.
Oh, great. Yeah. So don't unmute yourself, please, until I call on you. But Bob and I will do, and David will do our best to answer you. And Corwin, who cannot even check yes, is raising his hand. So we'll start with you, Corwin.
Anyway, thank you so much for the lovely talk. I found myself sort of smiling, laughing internally while Bob Sensei was talking, because I made so many mistakes in that sutra service. and you know, in the old days, maybe even being as of a couple of months ago, I would have turned bright red, my face would have gotten really hot, my stomach and everything would have clenched. And this time I'm like, oh, okay. Because I think it's because I realized that even though I messed up, I don't know how many times, you know, somehow the sun is still shining outside. And chances are most of you on the screen probably didn't notice maybe any of them. Some of you maybe didn't notice. Some of you probably didn't notice all of them. Paul and Alan probably noticed every single one of them. But, you know, the sun keeps shining, and, you know, the session goes on. And it actually reminded me that, you know, some of you may know I'm working towards ordination, and one of the requirements is I have to fall on my butt in public at least once, figuratively or literally. If you were here last year's summer session, I actually fell literally on my butt. But one of the beautiful things about it is so many times when we fall on our butts, nobody else even knows it, but we think the world is ending. Mm-hmm. And it's like, you know, we put this funny mask on that, like, wow, I'm the person who screws up all the time, but I'm the only one who sees that mask, you know, 99% of the time. Mm-hmm. And it's just so freeing. So yeah, doing our best is usually perfect as far as anyone else is concerned. So thank you.
Thank you.
And Corwin, I love this because, you know, I'm starting my Dharma talk at the wrong time because I started before we did the chants on opening the sutra. And I'm thinking, why does Corwin keep muting me? And why won't he let me talk? And I'm thinking, what's wrong with Corwin? And then I realize, oh my gosh, oh no. Falling on my butt.
This is the great example that many teachers use of watching a swan glide by on the water and the feet are going. we just got a new computer thanks to the generosity of the Hemera Foundation, and we're struggling to how to use it, and we have a list of things that we're supposed to go through, the officers and the teachers, and that particular thing wasn't on the list. So, and here we are, right, to do the gatha. So wonderful. Yeah. All perfect. All the different parts of the self. So Barry, let's go to you.
Thank you for the profound talks. I wanted to say it's not always bad to have heads on top of heads. As with Northwest Coast totem poles, the bear's head atop of a whale's head, on top of an eagle's head, on top of a beaver's head. And I often feel like a totem pole with lots of different heads. And the talk suggests to me, I don't need to chop any of them off. I need to have them sit around the kitchen table and get along and integrate and be open.
Yeah. Right. Oh, I love that totem pole image, following along with this idea of many selves. It's not that there's no self. It's that there are many selves. I appreciate too this idea that the point is not to figure out who's the best self and then only, I will only have the beaver. Beaver is clearly better than bear or eagle. Anyone can see that. But this idea that we need all the selves, the competent one, the incompetent one, the procrastinator, the action one, and everybody gets invited to this banquet. Yeah, thanks.
Thanks, Barry. Dawn.
Hi, yeah, I rose my hand because I didn't want to raise my hand.
Okay.
And that's pretty much how, I don't know, my entire, that's the energy of this for me right now, is just totally resistant to the whole thing. And I think part of that is because, you know, right now I am procrastinating Buddha. And it's like, you know, I don't know. There's just, I don't know. I think that's all.
Yeah. Well, you know, we those of you who have been around us for long enough know that we tend to say, whatever's going on for you, that's that Buddha. So the procrastinating Buddha or the rushing Buddha or the happy Buddha or the angry Buddha, they're all Buddhas. Buddha, 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 Buddha. And again, it's like the totem pole, with all the different heads on it. We are all these ones, but they come and go. So you're also the one who is resisting it. You know, that's, you got to own that completely, but not as the whole self. It's because another part of you shows up, which is another paradox, right? I really think that this capacity that we're training ourselves in to be with paradox, the paradox of the self and the paradox of action, which is another thing that Linji's pointing to so beautifully. This is a great gift to the world. If you can learn how to do this and then look around and see that there's totem poles everywhere. People are walking around with multiple selves, but they only pick one. And many of us just pick the worst one to think that's who I really am. You know, so just to appreciate both of the selves you've just shown us, Don, the procrastinating self and the resistant self. And I guess there's a third self, the one who shows up and raised her hand. Thanks. Yeah. Matt.
I guess I'm going to chain right off what you just said. So in my life, personally, and also just as a citizen or just living in this country, I feel surrounded by contradictions. Contradictions between what people say and what they do, or people between what people think they think and what their behavior shows they really think, and all kinds of things like that. So my question is, and sometimes I ask questions when I've made up sort of my own answer, but I'd like to see if it can be replaced by somebody else's answer. In this case, the question is, so there are contradictions. And sometimes a contradiction is a paradox that if you follow it down, will open up to something amazing and releasing and liberating. And sometimes a contradiction is just a lie, mythology, bullshit. And it's an attempt to manipulate you to sleight of hand, like, to make you buy into an illusion. And how do you tell the difference? And what part of you tells the difference? Kind of like that. So that's my question.
It's so wonderful to see a demonstration of how your mind is working right now.
Oh, and what's right?
What?
Yeah, how it's working right now, yes.
Yeah, yeah, right. That, you
I'm
know,
trying to feel it in my body. How do I know in my body? Can I tell in my body what the difference is? How do I know
maybe,
that?
Maybe. What do you think?
I don't know. I sort of intuit it. I sort of like get a whiff of it.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and the thing is, you know, do you ever tell lies? Do you ever have this paradox yourself?
Sure. Of course I tell lies. Usually so small.
The way to investigate this question, and you've probably already done this, is to look inside, and when you're actually, so there's a self that knows the truth, you know, knows how many people showed up at the inauguration. And then there's another self that lies about it.
Mm-hmm.
And we've all done that. You know, we've exaggerated things, right? So what's going on? And you're right to point to the body. What's going on physically, emotionally, when we pay more attention to one side than the other?
It's easier for me to fall in love and like the phony story than it is for me to like the real story. Yeah. I think it's going to make other people like me more if I tell the phony story than if I tell the real story.
So there's a great example. So the one who really wants to be loved is the motivating factor for that self. Yeah. And I think that's, you know, this is the way forward. We have to look at how this is, how human beings are, how we are, and get down to the bottom. And as you say, sometimes something wonderful happens, but sometimes something really agonizingly painful happens. Oh my God, I can't believe that's what motivates me. Of course, always remember it's what motivates that part of you. Yeah.
And I just want to, Nat, I just want to applaud you for naming this, because the confusion around what's real, what's true, is so much more alive, I think, for all of us right now. But there are, you know, discernment is a process, and there are things that are real. There's a, what's the John Mellencamp line? When I fight reality, reality always wins. That sometimes there is just this in some situations, not every, but there is just this. And as we look and look again and look again, some things turn out to be true and some things turn out not to be true. And that's what our teachers keep pointing us to. They point us to paradoxes, to ambiguities, but they also point us to truths that keep showing up for us over and over again.
And I think of Manjushri, the Bodhisattva of wisdom, who's always depicted with a sword. And that in some ways our practice is saying yes to everything. Truth and lies are all the dances, the waves on the surface. But in some ways the sword is necessary to cut through the delusion, the lies everywhere. That there is some heart and there is some way of being in the world and acting with wisdom and compassion that we are called to.
Yes. Yeah. Thank you. And because of time, we're not going to be able to get to everyone. So, Chris Amaralt, you have the last word in the Dharma dialogue.
Corwin, I so deeply resonated with what you said and have so often found myself in this exact moment where I'm chanting or leading the chant and it's going pretty well. And I stop and I think, I'm doing the thing. And that's exactly when I screwed up. When I say, God, man, you're the best practice leader. So it was so interesting to bump into this word, nothing, and hear that it's no thing. It's not, I think we smushed those two words together. So I think it's not don't chant. It's don't turn chant into a thing.
Right.
Like do the thing, but don't add the thing on top of the thing. So I just want to say, you were speaking to my heart, man. I had to tell you that. So.
Well, and this is, you know, this head on top of the head. So there's chanting and then there's the one who's aware, oh, I'm chanting, and then offering his humble opinion of plus or negative.
Mm.
You know, we can be seduced. Well, this is good because, you know, but it's just an opinion. And beneath that and including that, there is just the chanting. We don't even know how we speak. Like, if you had to tell me how to make the ah sound or to pronounce, you know, I don't know how my voice works. Where did the words come from? you know, there is this mysterious, the wondrous functioning.
The wonderful function.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yes. Yes.
Why in the world am I chanting these crazy Buddhist texts out loud into the... No, there's so many, and I can just go in any of those places and turn it all into, take the step back and analyze and jump.
Yeah. Yes, yeah. It's so important to see that. Yeah. I mean, this is what really we were looking at with Nat, when we asked that question at the beginning, you know, and Nat's very sincere. I don't know. There's something that where it all comes down to this, right? This is so, difficult to admit, especially for those of us who are well educated and who have been taught to rely on the mind figuring everything out. When it comes to the nature of the self, the nature of reality, the paradoxes that surround us, and we just want to figure it out, but we can't. Ultimately, we can't. The Buddha was really clear that there are some questions that he wouldn't answer. They were almost all about these kinds of things. Buddhism is full of paradox, but it's not just Buddhism. Life is full of paradoxes, and it moves back and forth and back and forth and back and forth. Yeah. So, yeah, thank you, Chris.
Yeah.
And we encourage those of you who had your hands up that we couldn't call on, to be brave another time.
So we'll sit for just a few more breaths before we receive our instruction for next practice.